to everybody. We'll be starting the class momentarily. Today we'll be taking up the topic of the temple as we're finishing up the last few parshas in Torah, Ve'akel and Pekudei. It's appropriate that we wrap up the Sedra, the parsha with the class today that will address that. And we'll just start momentarily. And again, once you hear the audio feed, just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. That will give us confirmation that you're picking up the audio properly. And then we'll start the class just in about a minute or so. We're waiting for our friends to join in by the phone. And if you miss any part of the class, you can always listen to it in its entirety. We post it on the audio link, which is about 7 or 8 links down. Actually, it's the 8th link down on the left-hand side of your screen. So if you do miss any part of the class, you'll be able to hear the class in its entirety by going either to the audio link or the new postings. We'll also have a link. Okay, in New York. Okay, Joshua, Indiana. Thank you for the confirmation. Purpose of the temple and the altar, what the relationship is between the two, just to give us more of an appreciation for all of these sections in the Torah that we've been reading the past few weeks and next week, the great detail of all the vessels, and primarily the temple and the altar, and what exactly is the purpose of all this. And we'll be referring to Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. And we'll put some quotes on screen. Okay, so to start, and that should be our friends. Hold on one sec. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. It's Doug Taylor.
Doug, how are you?
I'm excellent. How about yourself?
Doing well, thank God.
Good morning.
Good morning there, Cal. How are you? Oh, I sent an email last night. I wanted to give you some sort of a heads up, but it's okay. I'm going to put some text on screen right now. We'll start. And I'm just changing phones here, so if we get disconnected, you'll come right back, but I don't think we will. Hold on. Okay, still with me?
Yep.
Okay. All right, so today we want to address is, since we are finishing up next week with the parsha, the section of the Torah about the
entry and exit times are off.
Was that me or you?
I think that's the conference service.
Okay. All right. So I want to address. I don't think we had done this yet together. Just up to the primary concepts of temple and the altar. We read so much about it, there's so much real estate taken up in the Torah, there has to be some very central ideas here. I'm not sure if you're on the computer right now. I'm going to put some quotes on screen, but I'll read them as well. So for those of you that are on screen, you can take a look on screen. And then I'm also going to read them so you can see some of the text that we'll be referring to from Maimonides. This is from his Mishneh Torah, The Laws of the Selected House. So he says in law number one, chapter one, law one, he says, quote, it is a positive command to make a house to God prepared to offer the sacrifices in it. Again, it's a positive command to make a house to God prepared to offer sacrifices in it. In law three, chapter one, quote, once there was built a temple in Jerusalem, all other places became completely prohibited to build a house to God and to sacrifice in them sacrifices. And there is no house for all generations except in Jerusalem alone and on Mount Moriah, that it is there. As it states, quote, and David said, this is the house of God, and this is the altar of sacrifice to Israel. Again, King David said, this is the house of God, and this is the altar of sacrifice to Israel. And now comes a very interesting quote from Maimonides. This is the Laws of Selected House, Chapter 2, Law 2. And he says as follows, quote, and the transmission is in the hands of all. The place where David and Solomon built the altar, in the threshing floor of Arnon, it is the same place that Abraham built the altar and bound on it Isaac. And it is the same place that Noah built his altar when he exited from the ark. And it is the same altar that Cain and Abel sacrificed upon it. And on it, Adam the first sacrificed a sacrifice when he was created. And from there, from that location where he was created, the rabbi stated, Adam, from the place of his atonement, was he created. End quote. So this last law, in my mind, is saying that the exact same parcel of ground is where King David and Solomon built their altars, where Abraham sacrificed Isaac, where Noah built his altar when he exited the ark, where Cain and Abel sacrificed, where Adam sacrificed when he was created, and that is the location where Adam was created. Okay, very, very interesting statement. And this, he says, it's in the transmission in the hands of all. That means it's not a doubted fact. So it is quite interesting. This location was carried throughout time as being the location to offer sacrifice. And this is Mount Moriah. This is where the temple stood eventually. And once it stood there, it was not permitted to make it anywhere else. The temple had a few locations prior. There was one in Shiloh. But once it was built, once it was built in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, then it became prohibited to make the house anywhere else. Again, that was Maimonides' statement. Quote, he says, once there was built the temple in Jerusalem, all other places became completely prohibited to build a house to God and to sacrifice in them sacrifices. You note that he's constantly putting together in the same breath the temple, the house of God, and sacrifices, meaning the temple and the altar seem to have this age-old relationship. Okay. So this is one question I just wanted to pose. How's the sound over there today, by the way, Doug, Cal?
That's great.
Sounds good? Okay. All right. So this is one primary question. What is this relationship? Because we have King David saying, this is the house of God, and it is the altar of sacrifice to Israel. In one breath, he says this. Now, let me just give you some more, if that is not enough to show that there is a relationship between the temple and the altar. Now, in Genesis 28:17 through 19, this is when Jacob was fleeing from his brother Esau, who sought his life after taking the birthright. So Jacob had arrived at a place where he slept. And after Jacob awoke from his famous dream of the ladder with the ascending and descending angels, he made the following statement. Okay, this is Genesis 28:17 through 19. And he says, quote, and he was afraid, and meaning Jacob was afraid, and he said, this is upon his, when he woke up from the dream of the ladder, And Jacob said, quote, how awesome is this place? This is no other than the house of God, and this is the gate to heaven. And he called the name of the place Bethel, God, meaning God's house, Base Kael, the house of God. And later on in Genesis, many years after that quote, it states in the Torah, quote, and it says, and this is Genesis 35:1, and God said to Jacob, arise and ascend to Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esav. So when Jacob, his troubles were terminated, this is after leaving Laban, so God commanded him to return to the place which Jacob called the house of God, and now God said to him, make an altar there. So now you see God endorsing this concept where the place that Jacob said, and that again is Mount Moriah, that same exact location. So God is now telling him, you're missing something. You have to go back there and now make an altar in this place, because he didn't do that. He only set up a monument and poured some oil on it to signify the significance of the location because of the dream. And again, the quote from David. David said, this is the house of God, and this is the altar of sacrifice to Israel. That's in Chronicles 1, 22:1. So it's Chronicles 1, 22:1. You see again that a great individual, King David, is making a relationship and a statement. And if it's in the Torah, that means that God is endorsing the statement as being a true relationship. The house of God and the altar of sacrifice to Israel. Okay, so again we have that David recognizes that, and we see that God makes sure that Jacob goes back and creates an altar in the place where he calls the house of God. And Maimonides' formulation of the whole reason why we have a temple, he says, quote, again, this is the first law that I read. It's the laws of the selected house, 1:1. And he says, quote, it is a positive command to make a house to God prepared to offer the sacrifices in it. So clearly, the house is, the temple is subordinate to sacrifice. It becomes a location at a certain point. In certain years past, there was no such thing as the temple. The days of Adam and Cain and Abel and Noah and Abraham. Again, it wasn't until after the sin of the golden calf, according to Sforno, that God now instructed us to make a temple as a response to the golden calf. And we'll address that. So I just want to, the first step here is just to highlight the significance of the relationship. First of all, what are these two? What are these two structures? And what is the relationship? What is the primary nature in Jewish law? Okay. Now I just want to read one more time the law that I think contains the first step that we will have to make. So let me read it again in case you're not in front of a computer there. And this is Maimonides and Laws of the Selected House, Chapter 2, Law 2. Quote, and the transmission is in the hands of all, that the place where David and Solomon built the altar in the threshing floor of Arnon, it is the same, Arnon is the name of a person, the Jebusite person, it is the same place that Abraham built the altar and bound on it Isaac. And it is the same place that Noah built his altar when he exited the ark. And it is the same altar that Cain and Abel sacrificed upon. And on it, Adam the first sacrificed a sacrifice when he was created. And from there was he created. Meaning from that location was Adam created. The rabbi stated, quote, Adam from the place of his atonement was he created. End quote. Okay, so let's keep it very loose and just open up now the question to be, what is the significance of temple? What is the significance of altar? Let's try to see if we could try to approach defining what the significance of each is.
Rabbi, is the fact that Adam was created there kind of a starting point
and since that was the origin of mankind, that somehow then the significance of what is done in the temple and the altar needs to sort of circle back to that place?
Perfect. I could not have said it better. Exactly. Meaning the significance of something is at its inception. So if the descendants of Adam and Noah and Abraham and Jacob and David and Solomon are all going back to this place, we have to understand, when did this place achieve its inceptional significance? Exactly. So you're saying properly that it was, well, the first thing which happened at this location was that Adam was created here. Very good. Okay, what's the next step you have to make now?
Rabbi, it seems like it's all a common link to God there. I mean, that may be a part of what Doug had said.
Well, you can work it out with him, who's plagiarizing who right now, but it's all right. If he says it's okay for you to plagiarize his answer, that's all right with me.
Feel free.
Feel free. So it's harkening back to God. It's true. It's a very general statement, though.
Right.
Well, it seems like the next step, then, is we've got to figure out what's the connection between what you would do at the temple and the altar and the fact that this was the location of the origin of mankind.
Well, let me ask you a question. What? It's true. I mean, you have to understand what's the relationship between it and the origin of man. But the statement I quote from Maimonides that includes a statement that says, if you don't have it in front of you, so I'll read it to you again. On this altar, Adam the first sacrificed the sacrifice when he was created. What does that teach us? As soon as Adam was created, the first thing he offered a sacrifice to God. Let's understand this concept. What is the idea that propelled Adam to now make a sacrifice? As soon as he recognized he was now in existence, he reflected on himself as soon as he was created. I mean, imagine that. A person just becoming aware at the same time that he's now being created, and he knew that he was not in existence a moment ago. So what is
that? Well, I find that a tough concept because it doesn't seem like the first thing that you would do, having realized that you're a living creature, is to turn around and end the life of another living creature.
Unless he understood that everything was subordinate to Adam. Everything was subordinate to man. That's a statement which I think King David made, right? Yes, in his Psalms, he says, the heavens belong to God, but the earth he had given to man. He had given to the sons of man. The heavens are to God, but the earth he has given to the sons of man, meaning that everything on the earth is subordinate to man. And God even says, Adam, he says, conquer the earth and rule over the animals. So why was the taking of a life something which now we're getting closer? Why is taking something which is living and rendering it dead the right act for Adam to do as soon as he's created? I mean, it's true, Doug. The way you asked the question makes it sound... like it's insurmountable, but it can be answered.
Well, okay, it would seem like the sacrifice either has to be of benefit to someone or some entity. So it would seem like it either has to be a benefit to Adam, or it either has to be a benefit to Hashem. Yeah, I can't see that it would be a benefit to Hashem.
No, God has no needs.
Right. So then that raises the question, how could a sacrifice be a benefit to Adam?
Right.
The only thing I can think of is that it sort of solidifies the concept that man will rule over everything else on earth. But it's also recognizing that then God is reigns over man.
Right. I mean, sacrifice is sacrifice to God. That's the definition of sacrifice.
Right.
But has Adam even been given a permit to sacrifice at this point? I mean, if you're suddenly made a guest in someone else's house, you don't have the right to go around and, you know, break the dishes or, you know.
Evidently, he had mature intelligence at this point. He was not created as an infant with a complete blank slate in his mind.
Well, he had to have worked out a rationale as to why that was the right thing to do.
Right. Well, again, if God had told him that, I'm not sure when it was before or after the sacrifice, but the fact is that God does endorse man's subjugation of everything else on earth. So that was a concept which is a true concept. I can't say with any certainty at what point Adam had this. Was he created with this knowledge? But the, if we think about what he's doing, he's taking life and he's rendering it not living anymore. And what was Adam's transition right now? He went from a non-existent thing to a living being. So I'll suggest that the reason why he immediately created sacrifice upon his creation was an admission that he is not really something which should exist. There's nothing in reality which demands that man must exist. It's something which God did. God decided to be kind and create a being that can perceive him and enjoy a life of wisdom. So as soon as Adam was created, what happened was he recognized that I don't always exist. The only thing which has essential existence is God. That is the only thing which must exist. I do not have what we call necessary existence. I don't have to exist. So he wanted to demonstrate that realization, since he was such a perfect individual. A perfect individual is very much in line with reality and expresses that in his actions. So what he did was he wanted to demonstrate his conviction in his own dependent existence by saying, I really shouldn't exist. It's only because of God's good graces that I do. And I want to express this somehow. So he took an animal and he slaughtered it to demonstrate this is really what I should be. It's true that God created me and I do not have a right to take my own life. It's God's will that man has intelligence and nothing else. And I can perceive these truths. Animals do not have intelligence, so they are not on par with me. I have a right to subjugate the animals. So the most appropriate act right now was that now that I see that I am created and I really don't deserve to exist, it's only from God's own goodness, so I want to demonstrate that conviction that I really don't have necessary existence, that my existence is really created, and I really, my true state is really not to exist. So it's only because God decided to create man for whatever reason. I mean, even saying God had a reason is stepping over the bounds. You're saying there's some motive that God had, and that's a human quality. God doesn't have reasons. But what Adam was doing was making a demonstration. I am created. I don't exist by definition. It's not a necessary thing that I exist. And we discussed this a few weeks ago, that man had to have a command as soon as he came onto the world stage. And we explained. You remember what we said? That man can't feel that he just has to exist. No. Man's existence, God was saying, by giving Adam one command, God said, you exist, but only on a condition that you recognize me as creator and that you look to me as being the authority. So a command achieves that setup of a relationship that, that man is now subjugated to God, and God is the authority. So that's what command means. It means that he can be commanded. Man is the one that's subordinate. So the same concept of, was the that was the same concept of the sacrifice. Okay, let me pause for a second. Let me hear your responses. If anybody who's joining us online has any comments, you type them onto the screen as well. Please join in. Okay, go ahead. Let me hear your thoughts.
I hear it, and I suppose it hinges on that idea that he fully understood that the animals were subjugated to him.
Yes.
Because I mean, my initial reaction is it seems odd that he would take one of the creatures that Hashem created and destroy it.
Well, if he was created with full knowledge, the ability to speak, that means he had a very high... I mean, Ibn Ezra says that Adam was a great intelligence. He was a great intellect. So he must have had the most primary of concepts, which is, can I use with you know the physical world? This is relatively just a technical question. I mean, it's philosophy attached to it as well. But I'm sure he had this knowledge. I mean, the fact is that God also gave them animal skins to cover themselves after they sinned. Again, endorsing the idea that animals are subordinate to man.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we do see that this is a recognized truth. Okay. That's good, Cal? Brad?
I guess this is just the first time I've ever heard that that was the first thing that Adam did. I always thought that the first idea of death came about with Cain and Abel.
The first idea of death. Well, they sacrificed also. Before Cain killed Abel, they were involved in sacrifices as well. Animals and sacrifices of produce. I'm not sure, again, I can't say for sure this is the first act, but I'm just quoting Maimonides, that Adam sacrificed from the place that he was created. So now, we understand what the inception of sacrifice is, like Doug, you said earlier, that the very first time sacrifice existed, it was as a demonstration that man is really not a necessary existence. He doesn't have to exist. He's not doing anything for God. God doesn't benefit from anything he makes. But it's an attempt of man to demonstrate that my existence is really independent. How do I demonstrate that my existence really doesn't have to be here? I take existence, I take animal life, and I kill it to show this is really what I should be. So that's the very concept. If you had to pinpoint what is the most central idea in sacrifice is that man is now making a statement that I should be like this animal, that my existence is real, not because of sin. Adam didn't sin yet at this point in sacrifice, that he's trying just to make a demonstration that my existence is not something which has to be. And how do I embody that in action? I take an animal and I slaughter it, and now I see it, and it's dead. That is really what my nature should be. So it's a truth. It's just it's an idea based on what he sees in reality. And again, the reason why he has to follow through with action, as we said many times, is that man is wired a certain way. God created us in a way where if we do not follow through in action, if our thoughts, we can be convinced in our mind of something, but if we do not follow through in action, that shows that there's a gap, that there's some area that's not convinced truly. There's an emotional block of some sort, or we don't really grasp the concept. Because if man is truly convinced of something, he performs an action to demonstrate it. That's just the way we are. So this is why sacrifice and action was necessary, because that really reflects it. And Ethics of the Father says the same thing. It talks about two different types of people. A person whose learning is more than his actions, or a person whose actions are more than his learning. So the one whose actions are more than his learning is more praiseworthy. And they equate him, they say, for example, the person who has more learning than action, so it's like a tree with many, many branches, but very few roots. And a wind will come and it'll just uproot the tree. But a person whose actions are more than his learning is like a tree with few branches, but many, many roots, and all the winds of the world cannot uproot that tree. Meaning the roots, meaning to say he acts on it. There's a conviction in what his knowledge is. He may have less knowledge, but if he has conviction in what he has learned, then he performs actions, because that is something which is just the natural way that man responds to convictions. So that was Adam. He was perfected naturally. He was created perfected. Okay. Any comments, or should we move on to the next step?
We're ready for the next step.
Okay, so now that we know the primary significance of sacrifice, let's understand Maimonides' other statement that all those other people have sacrificed at the same location. So what is the concept that all others had sacrificed at that very same parcel of ground? Were they the original, or were they the duplication?
Well, it seemed they're duplication.
All right, and what does duplication teach?
You try to duplicate as close as possible to the original.
For what reason?
To try to preserve
good, perfect.
Yeah, I mean, you want to make the duplication as much a duplication as possible.
Right, you want to preserve a true concept. Exactly. Okay. They all saw the truth in this. I mean, the most important lesson man can echo throughout all generations is that we are created. We have and that means, by definition, that there is a creator. And to echo this theme is the primary concept. It's one of the 13 principles, that God alone is the one that we should pray to, that we should relate to. But we see another idea in Alter now as well, and that is that we want to have a relationship with God. That man, again, this is another facet to the concept that, like I said again, that when man was created, Adam had to have at least one commandment. Meaning that God was now showing there is a relationship, but man should want to approach God, because man's existence on earth without that is futile. There is no purpose to man's existence without trying to achieve a relationship to God. To pray, praying to God, or to sacrifice, which is an expression that I accept my role and that I want to understand God. And now we can approach a bit the concept of temple, as we were saying, that King David said. He said, this is the house of God, and this is the altar of sacrifice to Israel. And the first law that in Laws of the Chosen House by Maimonides, he says, quote, it is a positive command to make a house to God, prepared to offer the sacrifices in it. So the house, the temple, is made for the purpose of offering sacrifices. And we say also that Maimonides said in Law 3 that once they made the temple in Jerusalem, then no other place was allowed to have the temple anymore. Because now the temple was being built in the very same place where Adam was created. So it ends up that the relationship between the temple and the altar is that altar is really the expression of man, that he desires to relate to God, that he recognizes that this is his objective in life, and that by killing the animal, I demonstrate that my life is really dependent, but it's only dependent on the fact that I approach God. So the one act of killing an animal on an altar to God, I straddle both of those concepts. You see how nice it works out, that by taking life and rendering it non-existent, non-existent, so then I am embodying my true nature is not to exist, and I'm only existing because the second idea is that I have a relationship to God, that I try to live that life. Okay, and Sammy is on screen, is asking a question. How do you know when and if God forgives man for sinning? Does God punish you automatically each time you sin? Okay, that's not what we're taking up right now, Sammy. Okay, so let's just hold off on that. If you'd like, feel free to send an email. I'll answer you dependently. You can send an email to office@mesorah.org. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead, Doug.
So, I can understand that you're trying to duplicate the true idea, but it seems like the actual physical location of where you do that really doesn't have a bearing as long as you have the right understanding. So why is the location so important?
Okay. Good question. But the... So there's another idea here which I thought of, and that is that it's true that they had it's true that they had the temple in other locations, but the temple, actually, keep in mind, according to Sforno, is a response to the golden calf, meaning that since the Jews, even at that moment, they were about, this week's Parsha, that they were about to receive the Torah, they miscounted, they were afraid that Moses, the quote man that took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to them, meaning why did they say Moses, the man who took us out of Egypt? Evidently there was an over attachment to Moses, to the physical, and when that physical leader they thought was now dead, that's why they quickly created some sort of a physical form, a golden calf. So we see that man has a real, it's very difficult for man not to live in the tangible world. So as a concession to man's frailties, what God did was, according to Sforno, is at that point the temple was now going to be a necessary item as a response. Really, the initial plan was not to have any temple. You would just continue having sacrifices. That was something which would happen from day one. But now that man had the inability to express himself and worship God without any tangible worship, so God created temple, but as a way to redirect man to the correct ideas. That's why the focus of temple is the Holy of Holies, a room which is off limits. Meaning, since the very rampant expression the Jews had displayed by creating an animal, that's completely idolatrous. But it does express that man has a need to have some physical expression. So we allow them to have temple, a location with objects, but all these would now target the goal that what's a central part of temple is a room that you cannot enter into, and if you do enter into it, you'll be killed. Meaning you have to understand that you cannot know God. You cannot come up with your own type of worship. That's what you did by Mount Sinai with the golden calf, and that's why those 3,000 people were killed, and God also had killed many more with a plague after the 3,000 were killed by the Levites by the sword. So you see that that type of expression completely removes a person from the right to life, and that's why they had to be killed. So God makes a concession and says you can have physical expression, but it has to be very, very directed. And you see what detail there is in the temple. So much real estate in the Torah is dedicated to describing the objects, the size, when you use them, what type of offerings, how do you carry the animals and the limbs, and so much detail. This is, as Rabbi Chait explained years ago, that we need to have a high degree of control, to limit and remove any type of emotional, human subjective expression that could be idolatrous. So to have all these very precise laws does not allow the human emotions an out. So they have to be controlled if we're going to use physical objects. So this is why we have temple, according to Sforno, as a response to man's need for physical expression, but that very response is a very, very directed and precisely formulated system, with the goal that man knows that I cannot go into this Holy of Holies. I cannot approach God. I do not know what God is. That has to be the underlying concept. Now, getting to your question, Doug, so what is the whole need for a specific location? I was thinking that perhaps once the temple was now built in Jerusalem, and Maimonides says that it cannot be relocated anymore, perhaps because this place in Jerusalem is echoing back to what initial event? Adam's creation, correct? Adam's creation, when he offered a sacrifice, was pre-Sinai. It was pre-golden calf. It was sacrificed in the most pure form. Not an act of sacrifice as a response to a sin of man by the golden calf, but the highest form of sacrifice, where man purely recognized God. So to have the temple in a location, it does achieve the same concept of temple anywhere, which is sacrificing to God, recognizing God, knowing that I really don't exist by any other reason than God wants me to have a good life. But if I now take that act of sacrifice and I make it in a fixed location of temple on Mount Moriah, now what I do is I underscore that idea of temple of a sacrifice with the concept of what the real idea was, and that's going back to Adam's times. So it brings to the picture, it calls back to the purest times, the best level, where man is simply approaching God because he's created. Temple in the other places carries with it the concept of response to the golden calf, because that's what temple is by definition. It's a response to the golden calf. But that's only a concession. But isn't there when you relate to God not from a concessionary standpoint, but from the initial mode of worship, that's a higher level. So you always want to target the higher state of man, which was pre-golden calf. And if I can, for one moment, there are two verses we had discussed it a couple of weeks ago. I believe it is Leviticus 18, 4 and 5. Let me just see if I'm correct. 18. Yes. Leviticus 18, 4 and 5, I believe, hints to this idea that there's always two states of man. There was pre-Torah and there's after the Torah. Now, pre-Torah, we didn't have a Torah, by definition. But the level of those people that were living, the B'nai Noach, that were living in the right lifestyle, that was without any type of a system, just using their intelligence. And this was Abraham. That's why God made a great nation from Abraham, because he demonstrated that just from his design alone, without any teacher, he was able to approach the right life. And you see that that's what God created Adam with, that ability. So you see, the Torah, I think, talks about this. It says, "My statutes you should do, and my statutes you should perform. V'yaschukosai, and another form of statutes you should guard, to walk in them." Right, that's talking about walking. Then the next verse says, it's Leviticus 18:5 now says, "And you should watch my statutes and my commands, that you should do them." Right, that you should do them. There it doesn't say walk. Now it says you should do them. Okay. So now what is the difference between saying that you should walk in them, but then he leaves it out? I'm thinking that the first verse is talking about how, even though we have the Torah today, but really that's only from a standpoint of command, that we must do it because we're commanded. But the state that we were in prior to having the Torah were people that just walked that way in life. So we should never lose focus. That's what I think these verses are trying to teach, perhaps, that we should never lose focus of that pre-Torah, there was a state, man had the opportunity to just use intelligence. And that's something which we should still carry with us today. We should still carry with us this concept that even though we must do commands by obligation, the first manner in which humans lived is where they followed intelligence just based on they had a few commands, that was it, but that was just to ensure that there was a semblance of society. But that's not where man should stop. He shouldn't just stop at those six. And you see, Abraham had uncovered a tremendous amount of ideas. So we see that there is a dual nature that man can live today. He lives by obligation, but also he can recall and still achieve a state where he is living out of a love. That's the whole concept of the love of God and fear of God. Fear of God means a person's functioning out of a fear, a coercion of sorts. But a love of God is where a person is so attached to the truth it makes sense to his mind that even without being told, he would do it. Perhaps also that's what's going on over here. There was a temple that was not in Jerusalem, and that was response to the golden calf. But then once it was in Jerusalem, now it embodied the expression of perfection that people had even before the Torah system. So it's a little long-winded answer, Doug, but you tell me if it's a clear answer.
Okay.
Well, I understand the idea that people would walk in them before Torah by just using their intelligence. I'm still not 100% clear on why that pulls us back to the same physical location.
Because that physical location was before there was any type of... It basically harkens back to those individuals who were living based on a perfected lifestyle without any real commands. They had just a few commands.
Oh, okay. So it's intended to remind us of that.
Yeah. That's my suggestion. That's my suggestion.
I get it. Thank you.
Yeah, it could be more to that than that. So it ends up then, we just want to formulate it, is that the temple and the altar, and also there's a concept, there's a law that the altar is placed right at the opening of the temple, meaning to say there's an intimate relationship between the two. So the positioning also shows that. And again, when God told Jacob, go back to the place where you had the dream and you called it the house of God, now go back and make an altar there. Again, we see that God is now endorsing the concept that altar has to be in, meaning when you recognize the place which is significant to God, then you must have altar. You must have the expression of showing that you accept that truth, that you are only a created being and that you really don't deserve to exist, and therefore killing an animal demonstrates that state of non-existence that man really should be in if it was not for God's, you know, goodwill. It's not something which is very easy for the human ego to swallow, because with all of our feelings and our accomplishments, to just accept the idea that we are created, it makes a person feel like a puppet of sorts, that I didn't put myself here. But that is really a very profound recognition. If a person can get to that level, and that will raise a person tremendously to have that cognizance that I am a created entity. I didn't always exist. A person should really take time just to ponder that, because it's a tremendous idea. It just really gives a person an appreciation. That is really what God is trying to do, is to give man the correct notions, and that will be the greatest state. That feeling, and it doesn't. Man normally feels that if he feels humbled and feels subjugated, that's a negative. Just the opposite. If it's truth, then it has to be a pleasurable concept. Now, Sammy is asking a question on the screen. A good question, Sammy. He's saying, doesn't the whole process almost seem like idolatry, like a avodah zarah, the fact that we are sacrificing an animal to God? Well, let me explain something, Sammy. Idolatry is only when you do an act which is not prescribed by God. You can also ask the same question about there are two figures, like human figures of gold on the ark, and we're not supposed to make any type of figurines. So how can we have a temple that the holiest of rooms has two, not one, but two gold humanoid figures with wings? Doesn't that sound like idolatry? Yeah, it sounds like idolatry, but idolatry is only if man invents it. But if God prescribes it, then it can't be idolatry. Okay, Sam, I hope that's clear. Okay.
Bye.
Cal, go ahead, you have a question?
Yeah, when God had instructed them to build the Mishkan when they were traveling around,
mm-hmm.
Then that doesn't signify the place as much as the concept.
Right, well, that was impossible to have it any other place. That's where they were. So it doesn't have, it had perfection to it, but once it reached a higher level of perfection by being stationary in Jerusalem, so then you could reach another idea, another truth, so we make it there. But it's not that there was any imperfection. It was just, you're right, it couldn't embody that idea. But it still addressed, you know, a number of great perfections, even in the wilderness. So you may have, like we have in Jewish law, sometimes there's a mediocre way to fulfill a command, and then there's a more perfected way, or more complete way of fulfilling a command. So we don't say, well, all or nothing.
But it also doesn't give the freedom to just sacrifice anywhere and any time you want, right? It has to be very specific.
Yes. That's what Temple introduced. Okay, so that gives us, I think, a nice understanding as to why location and, you know, sacrifice itself. I think these two ideas themselves are really nice finds. And just the fact that you have so many places in the Torah which put the two together. So again, the temple is now to have the altar is really the primary. We had to say which is more important, the altar's primary, because we see sacrifice is what happened from day one. Meaning the attempt of man to have, he must have, man's existence is all dependent upon if he lives a life based on a relationship with God. If you don't have a relationship with God in your life is useless, it's futile. So man recognized that, Adam recognized that, and created a sacrifice right away. And now what is that relationship? Number one is that there must be a relationship, but number two, the relationship is where we recognize our subordination to God. So that's why you kill the animal. The death of the animal is to embody that I really should not be in existence, just like this animal is no longer in existence. Okay, those ideas are clear?
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, to me, I really enjoyed that when I came across that, and I saw the Rambams, and I saw the verses. Let's see where else. I think... See if there's another parallel here. All right. Okay, we also see the idea of Sworno, why he says that temple is actually a concession. Because since there was a rampant expression, idolatrous expression, when it came to the golden calf, but that demonstrated a need for man to have some sort of, and that's what, you know, expression, some sort of a physical action in connection with God. And you see that God also told Moses when he went up to the mountain to get the tablets, he said you have to put a barrier around the mountain because maybe the people are going to break forth to see. What do you mean to see? Evidently, there's the feeling in man that he can see something in connection with God. I mean, man is we're sensual by definition. There's no escape. Everything that we do in life is tied to the physical. We're trying to raise ourselves intelligently to understand certain truths, but it was necessary even then that they had a guardrail to prevent them from going up to try to see something about God. And then God said, because perhaps many will fall, meaning God will have to kill many people that express any type of notion that God's physical. And we saw this happen there when the Philistines had returned the ark to the Jews. So it says that 57,000 were killed because they looked inside the ark when it came back. Okay, so we understand now how temple is a response. But at the same time, it's a response. It directs every single one of our ideas ultimately towards the fact that we really can't know God. So that's why we can't go into that room. That's what that idea expresses. And then what we'll do next week is we'll pick up with now if the Holy of Holies in the temple is something which you can't understand. So that's why you can't go in there. But the priests were allowed to go into the other room, the larger room called the Holies. And in that room you had the menorah, and you had the table of the showbread, and you had the incense altar. So if that's where man, meaning the priests, could enter into, so that must mean that these are things which we can know about in connection with God. Right? If we have one room we can't go in, it's to teach us that we cannot approach God directly in life, we can't know what God is. And even the high priest that goes in on Yom Kippur, he goes in there one time in Yom Kippur, what does he have to do when he goes into the Holy of Holies? He has to smoke up the entire room. Why? He has to demonstrate, again, he has to put a veil between him and the Ark. Because even he's got a danger of thinking, maybe there's something here I'm perceiving now, I'm closer to God, so to speak. But you're not closer to God than any physical location. And you have to know there's always a veil between you and God. So that's why he smokes up the entire Holy of Holies, to demonstrate, I may be coming in here, there's a worship I have to do, but I cannot know any more about God than I did outside, and I create a veil to demonstrate that. It even says, Maimonides says, that there's a tradition that the day that God gave the Torah on Sinai, it was cloudy and rainy. And you see, it was dark, too, and it says that Moses went into the thick darkness. You see, God there also used the concept of cloud and darkness whenever he did his revelation, meaning it's a double-edged sword. God wants to prove his existence, and he has to make manifest miracles. At the same time, man is in danger of thinking that he sees God. So that's why it was dark. So we see it's a theme in Torah, that there always has to be a veil. And perhaps that's why the very presence of God always, when they were in the desert, what was the presence of God embodying? They saw the cloud. Again, you see a third instance where cloud is being used, where God is now demonstrating that he is with the Jews in the desert, but at the same time, it's cloud. You can't see. You have to understand that there's something here that's true, but when it comes to God, you just don't know what he is. And cloud represents that there's a veil between us and God.
Rabbi, that was also displayed too when Moshe wanted to see God, and he just was able to sort of see the back, I guess, and not the face, in a sense.
Yes, exactly. This week's parsha. All right. He wanted to know God's true essence. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. We were discussing this yesterday. Now that you bring it up, there were two requests that he made. He said, teach me your ways and show me your glory, meaning your essence. So we see the words that Moses used. He said, teach me your ways, because teaching is something which can be communicated through intelligence. That's what a lesson means. A lesson means you say something, and I could use my mind. But Moses did not say that when it came to wanting to know God's true nature, because Moses recognized that that's outside of human capacity to use intelligence to arrive at. So that's why he didn't say, teach me. He said, show me. Just somehow make it known. Implant it in my mind somehow. You see, even the words that Moses used demonstrated that he saw a difference between understanding God's actions, that's God's ways, that we can see. We can see God's actions. But to know what God is, what he wanted to have some sort of an insight, that even the highest man Moses could not obtain. He could not obtain that. Yeah, and it's interesting that it must be that Moses exhausted all other pathways in life. He reached the highest level he could. And now he said, I can't go further without your assistance, God. It's an interesting idea. That man can, in a certain area, come to the limit of his abilities and then request God's assistance to go further. That seems to be what the reasoning is why Moses asked God. Otherwise, you could just use your mind to figure out mathematics or other areas. That you don't have to ask God to show you. You could work on that yourself. But there is, and that happened again one other time in history, but maybe just because of his youth, that when King Solomon became king at 12 years old, God appeared to him in a vision and said, ask what I should give to you. And perhaps because of his youth and he didn't have the time to achieve the knowledge necessary to run the people, so God now made it available to him at an early age. But that was perhaps unknown to him only because his short span of life that he had lived so far. But by Moses now being this old, it was due to the fact that he exhausted his own capacity and now requested assistance because there was something outside of his own abilities in terms of knowledge. But that's not, I don't think any of us today will have that problem.
Moses, yeah, but I find that interesting because it seems like that's embodied in the elements of prayer, where you do everything within your power and then you pray to God and recognizing that.
Yes, that's a good association. It's very good. That there's so much that we can do, and that's it. And there's so many other factors at play that we ask for God's assistance in that. Because we realize that there's just so, there's so, you know, there's only so much that we can do. And there's so many other factors in life that contribute to our successes, our health, and everything else. And it's an amazing thing that God can do this for all the billions of people on Earth. Really amazing. Okay. Any other questions or comments at this point? And let me see, Tikva seems to have a question. Let me just see what Tikva is writing on screen. When we were in the wilderness, there was a specific instruction as to where the tabernacle was to be placed. Although it was not the same physical location, wasn't it placed in the same sense of relationship to the camp? Yeah, there was a location for it, but it didn't have the significance of the Temple Mount, which is where Adam was created. So it's true. Temple definitely had to have a certain location. That's for sure, Tikva. But it's not place in terms of targeting the objective of mimicking that first sacrificial location, which was where Adam was created. Man's creation is really what we have to hearken back to when we look at the altar, because that was where the altar got its significance from at the very beginning. All right, so maybe next week we'll do is we'll pick up with this theme and now go into the vessels. What do all these vessels have to do with the temple? And what can we arrive at? What truths are they supposed to convey? They're very, you know, unique style vessels. And a menorah with 7 branches and 12 loaves of bread on a table. And an incense altar. And the altar where they sacrifice the animals. So we'll continue with this. We'll pick this up on this coming Sunday, next Sunday, all right?
Okay.
Did we ever touch on this before?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we never touched on this before, did we? Did we ever take up the temple or anything?
No.
No. All right, this is very basic, so I'm really glad we're doing this. I was like thinking about it. I was very busy this week. I was trying to think, what would we do this Sunday? And then last night it struck me, you know, that we're finishing up all these sections in the Torah about temple. You know, we never really did it on the live class here, so this is really an important thing to see. So I'm glad that the idea just popped up in my head to do that. All right, very good.
Great class, Rabbi. Thanks much.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
You have a great week.
You too. Enjoy. Any questions, feel free. You know, let me know during the week. And otherwise, take a look at the, all these, the sections that we just read, and just to get a backdrop on it.
Okay.
All right, very good. So have a great week to everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, be well.
Bye.
Okay, so that ends today's class. We'll continue next week, same time, 11:15 a.m. That's Eastern Daylight Time now. We hope you enjoyed it. Any questions, feel free to send an email to office@masorah.org. If you missed any part of today's class, it is recorded, and it will be placed shortly on both new postings link on your left-hand side of your screen and also on the audio page. So you can hear the entire class from the beginning. And we'll pick up next week at the same time. So everybody have a good week, and look forward to speaking to you then. Joshua, Indiana, good to see you. Jay Khanna in California, Canada, my pleasure. And Sammy and everybody else. Have a great day to everybody.